Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American military spending towers over the rest of the world's countries. American debt and deficit issues are looming large, too. Put the two together with long-running wars and deployments, and there's an audible voice out there to bring the troops and resources home. From Republican debate platforms to the halls of Congress to, this week, the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Here's Oklahoma City Mayor Mike Cornett.
If we're talking about rebuilding cities in eastern Afghanistan or rebuilding American cities, I'm for rebuilding American cities.
This hour on Point, American military spending and the urge to bring the troops home. You can join the conversation. Is it time to pull back? How much? How far? From Iraq, Afghanistan, Germany, Japan? Is that isolationism? Is it good sense? Is it necessary? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Of course, Ron Paul, Republican congressman, has been out there with this message for a long time, but it's resonating in a new way. Here he was in the Republican debate last week, calling for an end to the U.S. mission in Afghanistan and reconsideration of Mideast policy. If elected president, Paul said, he would bring the troops home immediately.
I wouldn't wait for my generals. I'm the commander-in-chief. I make the decisions. I tell the generals what to do, and I'd bring them home as quickly as possible, and I'd get them out of Iraq as well, and I wouldn't start a war in Libya. I'd quit bombing Yemen, and I'd quit bombing Pakistan. I'd start taking care of people here at home because we could save hundreds of billions of dollars. Our national security is not enhanced by our presence over there.
Wouldn't wait for the generals. Mitt Romney saying he'd get out of Afghanistan with attention to the generals, and lots of talk around the country and in the Republican Party. Senator John McCain has long been a strong defense defender. Yesterday on ABC's This Week, he said it's a mistake to leave Afghanistan too soon.
For us to abandon Afghanistan to the tender mercies of the Taliban and radical Islamic extremists, I think would be repeating the mistakes we made before.
And McCain called out the Republicans like Mitt Romney and others who have called for a quick end to the war in Afghanistan.
This is isolationism. There's always been an isolationist strain in the Republican Party, the Pat Buchanan wing of our party. But now it seems to have moved more center stage.
More center stage. But is it isolationism with all these wars going on? Yesterday on ABC's This Week, conservative columnist George Will said the U.S. government is overcommitted with five different wars.
The United States is engaged in hostilities in Iraq, Afghanistan, the tribal region of Pakistan, Yemen, and Libya. That's five wars. How many do these people want?
Well, that may be the question before the American people. Joining me in the studio today is Stephen Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Stephen Walt, welcome back to the show. Great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be here.
With us from Washington is Christopher Preble, director of foreign policy studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. They advocate a reduced global U.S. military footprint. Christopher Preble, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Christopher Preble, make the argument here. How much can come home from how many places, how quickly, and what difference would it make for the American debt and deficit fiscal situation?
Well, let me say at the outset that I think that the reality of our budget situation, that is the looming gap between our revenues and our spending, is focused attention on the military budget. But we're not going to close the military. We're not going to close the budget gap by cutting military spending. I just think that it makes sense to cut military spending, and would make sense even if we were running a surplus. The simple fact is that we are extraordinarily secure as a country. We should take solace in how secure we are and not assume that we need to be in dozens and, frankly, more than that, countries around the world in order to be safe and secure. Certainly the war in Iraq is drawing to a close. I think most people want it to. The vast majority of Americans now recognize that was a huge mistake. Increasingly, a number of Americans are starting to question the war in Afghanistan. At the outset, they were very supportive of it because it was connected clearly to the events of 9/11. But what we're trying to do now, almost 10 years after the fact, has really changed. The mission has changed a lot, and we just simply don't need to be there in those large numbers in order to hunt al-Qaeda. So I think that, we start with the wars that we've begun in the 2000, since 2001, and then we revisit the placement of troops in a lot of places around the world that are a legacy of the Cold War or even before that, you know, I just don't think it makes sense for the United States to continue to subsidize the defense of Europeans who are more than capable of defending themselves. And increasingly, I think there'll be some focus on the troops in East Asia and Japan and South Korea, two more countries that are certainly capable of defending themselves. And yet, in many respects, the U.S. presence in those countries has discouraged them from doing so.
We're going to look at the details here, how much might come home, how much it would really mean. What about defense spending at home in support of the sort of global strategy the U.S. has followed? But put in perspective for us, if you would, Christopher Preble, as we're looking at these enormous deficits that have everybody's attention now, just how much of our annual federal, you know, spending commitment is military?
Well, by the president's own, by the administration's own estimates, the U.S. military spending, defense spending, constitutes about 20% of total federal spending. Now, again, it's hard for people to get their handle around just how much money the federal government spends every year. It's about $3.8 trillion in current dollars. And of that, about almost $800 billion is U.S. military spending. By the administration's projections, they think that the percentage of military spending as a total of the federal spending will come down to about 15% by the end of this decade. But who knows, really? The fact is that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have not yet come to an end. And meanwhile, we've begun new ones. I think it was interesting that George Will pointed out that we're fighting five wars now.
He's including Libya, Yemen.
Right. And, you know, what we're doing in Pakistan. I do think we have to draw distinctions between the kinds of wars that we're conducting in Iraq and Afghanistan and more targeted missions elsewhere. But, you know, it's a point worth emphasizing that the United States military is extraordinarily engaged in many, many places around the world. And we certainly could be as secure as we are today, I think, frankly, more financially secure if we were spending somewhat less on our military and asking our military to do less around the world and expecting other countries to do more.
Stephen Walt with me here in the studio. Even Defense Secretary Gates, outgoing Secretary Bob Gates, talks about war wariness. He said, you know, he's grown very wary of wars of choice. Of course, you know, there's always a debate over whether it's a war of choice or not. We'll get into the details, but what about this country's latitude? Here we are looking at 20% of the budget in a time when a lot of it is committed to things like, you know, Social Security and Medicare and right on. That's a lot of money in terms of foreign deployments, in terms of military spending. How much latitude does this country have to look at that budget and say, as the mayors have at their conference this week in Baltimore, you know, we could use that money different ways. Let's bring them home. Let's redirect.
Well, we have a fair degree of latitude, although it's hard to just shift this all in a week or two. But
we'll grant that. But it's been years in these conflicts and with very, very large defense spending.
That's right. I mean, I think that obviously defense spending is only a part of the fiscal deficit problems that we're facing here. But it's, I think, increasingly recognized, including by Secretary of Defense Gates, that the military budget is going to have to be part of that solution. And he was basically sending a message in the last few weeks that the American military is going to have to get used to living on a much leaner budget than it has in the last decade or so, that the combination of the absence of any significant great power rival, the fact that we've fought several very expensive wars, which among other things means that we're going to have to spend a certain amount of money doing what's called recapitalizing the force, basically repairing, rebuilding some of the forces themselves. And then finally, the fact that we had a major fiscal meltdown, major economic meltdown here, all of that means that the American military budget is going to have to come down and that we are going to be a less capable force as a result. I mean, I think it's very important for people to recognize that you can't actually save a lot of money with the slogan, let's just bring all the troops home. In fact, putting troops in places like South Korea or Japan is not by itself particularly expensive.
But explain that for us. I mean, we hear $2 billion a week, I think I've heard, in Afghanistan, you know, $4 billion a day overseas. That, you know, when you're a mayor up against it, that sounds like a lot of money.
That is a lot of money, but that's the difference. It's one thing to have troops deployed in various places if they're not doing anything, if they're not actively fighting. Fighting wars is very expensive. Mm-hmm. We've spent roughly $1.3 trillion now in current budgetary terms on Iraq and Afghanistan combined. So fighting wars is expensive, but having, say, troops deployed in Japan is not by itself expensive. The Japanese government helps pay for it. And we would be paying those same troops if we had them in Kansas. We'd be paying them roughly the same amounts. About half the military budget is personnel costs, is procurement costs, buying ships, tanks, planes, things like that, and then doing research, development, things. All of those things would be unchanged if the American footprint in the world were smaller. The only way you save real money is if you actually shrink the size of the force. That's the just changing the places you move it is not going to save very much. And obviously, staying out of foolish wars helps too.
We'll look at that and the size of the force and spending at home in relation to the global sort of strategy and posture of U.S. forces. But Christopher Preble, we just have half a minute before the break. But you hear Stephen Walt saying, you know, why bring them home from Japan and Germany? Those are not that expensive. You're going to pay them in Kansas anyway, Christopher.
Right. Well, I wouldn't pay them in Kansas because what I'm proposing is that we don't merely relocate the troops from Okinawa to Fort Lewis, Washington, but we actually reduce the size of the force. And if you do that, then you can achieve substantial reductions. But Steve's right. You can't make these savings if you're just relocating troops from one place to another.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking today with Money Short about bringing the U.S. military home from all over. The sound of interest in that is out there these days. Of course, Iraq and Afghanistan, long, wearying wars. Many Americans, polls show, quite tired of those, ready to turn around, go the other way. But how much, how fast, how far, and what about the U.S. military budget at home when deficits and debt are so high? Big issues around spending. Robert Gates, outgoing defense secretary, talking over the weekend about his concerns if it goes too far. He said recently he's become very wary of wars of choice. But here he is warning that cutting defense to save money may be a bad idea.
I worry that people whose primary worry and concern is the economy and the deficit will see defense and our engagement around the world as a way to reduce those obligations and that deficit. I believe that misstates the problem.
Misstates the problem. We'll look at that. Secretary Gates made the case that by historical standards, spending now, not so high.
The base defense budget is not part of the deficit problem. Our percentage at the base budget, not counting the cost of the wars, the defense budget is about 3.5% of GDP. That's basically the lowest it's been, except for a brief period in the late 90s, since before World War II.
Base budget. But of course, on top of that, we have definitely had wars of late. Christopher Preble with the Cato Institute joins us from Washington. Libertarians, he's looking for pullbacks in spending. Stephen Walt of Harvard's Kennedy School is with us. Right now from Boulder, Colorado, we're joined as well by Rachel Kleinfeld, co-founder of the Truman Security Project. It's a progressive think tank that advocates for a strong national defense. Rachel Kleinfeld, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Terrific to be here, Tom.
You've heard all the calls, and just this week again, and late last week at the mayor's conference in Baltimore. I mean, here's Mayor Ryback of Minneapolis says that cities are being forced to, quote, make deeply painful cuts to the most core services while the defense budget continues to escape scrutiny. Here's Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles said the idea, quote, that we would build bridges in Baghdad and Kandahar and not Baltimore and Kansas City absolutely boggles the mind. Christopher Preble with the Cato Institute says, let's bring them home and let's make significant cuts here as well. What do you say, Rachel?
Well, I think the American people understand that our national strength is highly tied to our economic strength. But we've done a very bad job of keeping threats small and far away, spending development money, spending money on diplomacy instead of spending money on active wars. Our base military budget is $550 billion, but these wars are costing over $200 billion. So you have a very different situation when you're actively at war. We need to be much more careful, and we need to move money to where it's most needed. But that does not mean cutting all of our security. There's a real need for some of our security spending. We just need to be a lot smarter about it.
Nobody, I'm sure, would say cut all of our spending. But Christopher makes the case, look, the Cold War's over, and yet we linger on in these places. Maybe there's a different strategic posture in the world. European countries, since the end of the Cold War, have certainly cut back dramatically. The United States, not nearly as much. Isn't there room for more here, Rachel?
Well, we're deployed in an awful lot of countries where there's room to cut. But each cut requires us to think about what are the costs and what are the benefits. So if we cut some of our 50,000 troops in Germany, we lose base hospitals. So that means cutting troops from Afghanistan, which we're doing. They just need to be done in order, in a thoughtful manner, and realizing the repercussions of these cuts. In some cases, though, you don't want to cut too much. The UK can't keep up a force that is just doing bombing in Libya right now. They're very embarrassed by the fact that they're borrowing our equipment. If they can't handle a fairly small war in one country, that doesn't bode well for real threats in the world.
Christopher Preble, describe a different kind of global strategy that would permit this reduced presence abroad and reduced spending at home that you're imagining. I'm assuming you're not saying we don't need defense by any means, but if there's a change that would make significant savings, what would the outline of that different posture look like compared to what we've been doing lately?
Right. Well, I think it begins by redefining what it means, what defense means. I think we throw that term around far too loosely. I try to emphasize there's a difference between military spending and defense spending. Defense is a core function of government. You know, it's in the Constitution. It's something that I still care deeply about. But my question, and really I'm frankly deeply puzzled by the fact that many other countries, Rachel mentions the UK, they have a security challenge in their neighborhood, and yet they have turned once again to the United States to defend them. Now, at some level, I don't really blame them. The United States has effectively infantilized many of our allies by spending so much on defense that they've allowed their capabilities to atrophy. And I say over time we should focus on defense being a core function of all governments, not the United States defending the entire world from all threats. And if we were to do that, then we could make responsible cuts over a gradual period, 10, 15, 20 years. And I think the end result is a United States spending less on defense and other countries spending somewhat more, and in the end result being better security, more security around the world than just one country being responsible for spending most of it.
So is that a fundamental reduction in global defense spending? Cold War's over, we don't really need it? Or is it just cost shifting to American allies, and can they really afford to step up and do that? What if they can't?
I think it is a fundamental shift. I mean, it's interesting that Secretary Gates mentions U.S. spending as a percentage of GDP. It's true that as a percentage of a total output, U.S. spending is not very, very high. But in real terms, in real inflation-adjusted terms, we now spend more on our military than at any time since the end of World War II. Now, if you believe that the threats we are facing are greater than the threats we faced at the height of the Cold War with a nuclear-armed Soviet Union and a hostile Maoist China, then that makes sense. But if you don't believe that, if you're like me, if you think that most of the threats we're dealing with today are far more manageable than what we were dealing with in the 70s and 80s, then we should be able to spend less. And frankly, I think a lot of other countries around the world would not match us dollar for dollar, but they can defend themselves more easily than we can defend them at a remove of 7,000 miles.
Rachel, here I'm looking at Lawrence Korb and others talking about U.S. military spending. This is a former, Deputy Defense Secretary, saying U.S. military spending has risen to nearly half the global total. Worth dwelling on that. Almost half of everything spent on the planet on military is spent by our country, but the U.S. share of global economic output is eroding steadily as other economies grow faster, suggesting that's a formula that just won't work, that we can't afford the posture we've had, Rachel.
Well, Chris and I agree that you really need to shift spending. It doesn't make sense to spend so much on the military when other threats that are quite real can't be solved militarily. So you're looking at security spending, not military spending. What can the military do against a bioterrorism attack? What can it do against a terrorist sleeper cell in Milwaukee? Nothing. It's not the military's job. So when we think about security spending, we need to think about spending in much smarter ways. Some of that's on infrastructure at home that allows us to be stronger here at home. Some of that is increasing our allies' spending, stopping the infantilization. I agree with Chris 100%. And some of it is simply cutting parts of the budget to move money to where it's more needed. We need money in development. We need money in diplomacy. If we hadn't abandoned Afghanistan in the 90s, we probably wouldn't be there spending the $200 billion a year that we've been spending in Iraq and Afghanistan lately.
Let's get our callers in, and I'll come to Stephen Walt on this. Tony in Washington, Indiana. Tony, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you see?
Well, I think it's imperative that we reduce the military spending across the world. We're having so many problems here with our infrastructure. We just can't afford it. I think it's a shame that we are spending so much money across the world, and you know, we're laying off teachers, laying off police officers, firemen, and the economy is going, you know, further into the hole. We need to concentrate all of our resources here, so in the future we can better help people, be in a better position to help people. If we continue to crumble, we're going to be in a weakened position. We're not going to be able to help anybody. So,
Tony, let us pick it up right there. You make the case very succinctly and well, very directly. Stephen Walt, you know, there's the formula. We're laying off teachers here. We're spending on defense all over. Let's take those resources, concentrate them at home, and, you know, try and get the economy and back in gear. That's Tony's articulated kind of the essence of what you're hearing a lot of people saying. How do you look at that as a strategic thinker?
This is a very familiar problem, and it's the problem between what you might call short-term readiness and long-term strength. So you spend more on your military and other security aspects, you might make yourself at least marginally somewhat safer in the short term. But if the consequence of that is that you're undermining the economic foundation that allows you to produce that power, you leave yourself weaker in the long term.
Do you see it as a seesaw like that? If one, you know, more military spending means reducing your economic...
This has been understood for as long as we've had militaries. This is what Eisenhower was worried about mm-hmm. in the 1950s when he talked about the Cold War being something where you had to focus on the long haul, and he worried about, you know, the military-industrial complex skewing our investments. And so what the caller is suggesting, I think quite rightly, is you have to strike a balance between what you think you need to be secure against immediate dangers and what you need to have to retain all of the other features of a healthy society, including an economy that is robust, a technological base that is second to none, a society where people are taken care of, where there's a lot of national unity, etc. All of those things can be undermined if you overinvest in short-term military preparedness, and certainly if you squander some of that in wars that should not have been fought in the first place. Now, then, how you balance that in terms of actual military strategies and where we're committed, what we're engaged in, is a separate question, which I'd love to get to. But
you describe a kind of – it seems to make a significant difference in the amount of spending. We'd have to kind of reconceive our role to some degree. If you want to do the same thing, it may cost you about the same amount. But is there – can you describe an alternate way of looking at this challenge or strategy that might bring us significant savings to, as the mayor say, build those bridges in Baltimore and Kansas City – you know, get the country, as Tony says, get it in shape.
I do think there is a sort of conceptual rethinking that has to happen here. We have to remember what the American military is very good at and what it's good for. It's very good at deterring and reversing conventional aggression. It's been very good over the past 50 or 60 years at stabilizing key regions where we were appropriately deployed. And we've turned out to be not bad at specific forms of counterterrorism, most recently in the killing of Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. We really did focus on finding him finally and capturing him. We are not very good at running other countries. We're not good at occupying and reconfiguring other societies. Our military is not designed to do that, and I would argue that our civilian side is not particularly good at that, which is why, of course, we're failing in Afghanistan and why Iraq was not particularly successful. So I would get out of that particular business and try to avoid these nation-building exercises whenever possible. I would, however, retain a robust enough defense capability that in the parts of the world we care about, we can maintain balances of power there as we need to. In practical terms, I agree with what was said earlier. We don't need to be doing much to defend Europe because Europe is safe and doesn't have any significant external enemies. We ought to be getting out of the Middle East as an active military presence because that's a place where our military presence on the ground there is a profound irritant to those societies.
Mm-hmm. May create the problems that we then have to work on.
And over time, we're going to be shifting a lot of our strategic attention to Asia, which will be primarily done with naval and air forces, not with ground troops. And that's a place where, first of all, a number of Asian countries are, in fact, increasing their defense investments because they're worried about China as a long-term problem. And they're very eager to have more American support, more American presence. So, you know, we go the places that we're needed and that we're wanted, and we stay out of the places where our active 24/7 presence is, in fact, undermining our overall security position.
You talked earlier, you said we have this absence now of a significant great power rival. But is that true? I mean, China is sitting there. It's certainly a great power, and many people see it as a rival.
China will have the world's largest economy some point in the next, you know, decade or two. It'll be the first time, by the way, since 1900 that the United States is not the world's largest economy.
Talk about a change.
Right. But the Chinese defense budget is about one-sixth that of the United States. It's growing by about 10% a year. I think there are lots of powerful reasons why the United States and China are going to engage in some level of security competition going forward, perhaps a very intense security competition, which is, again, why we're going to end up spending a lot more time focusing on Asia. And if we're going to be able to do that effectively, we're going to have to make sure we're not bogged down in other places where either the strategic stakes are not particularly vital, or in the case of the Middle East, which I think is a vital interest, where a large on-the-ground American presence is, in fact, undermining our position, and we ought to be operating offshore over the horizon with an intervention capability, but we keep it out of the region except when we need to be there.
Do it your way, and how much could we save? You know, famously now we're borrowing 40 cents on every dollar we spend, so do it your way, and how much of that $800 billion annual defense spending package could we save?
I think
put into bridges in Bridgeport.
Yeah, I think you could easily save, you know, a third of that and probably more.
That is significant in budgetary terms.
And again, some of that, of course, is not fighting the wars like Iraq and Afghanistan, which have been costing, you know, upwards of $150 billion a year.
Of course, that's easy to say, not fighting, but we're in deep there, still in deep in both of those with lots of troops. Let me go to John in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I just want to make a quick point. I listened to Robert Gates speak this weekend.
Yeah.
And a point that was missed in that I haven't heard really speak about much is that in reality, we've only really allocated 2 years of resources to Afghanistan. And without coming out and really pointing the finger directly at, you know, what most of the resources were wasted on, he pretty much said over the last 10 years, 8 of those years was allocated towards an effort that we really shouldn't have been in the first place.
Right.
And, you know, I don't necessarily want to see Afghanistan continued, but we have to do what we, you know, I think went in there to do originally with the resources. And there's really nothing more irritating to a veteran than to see an effort that he was told to go in there and do be squandered for the fact of politics. And it's also make one more point. It really sickens my stomach to see a lot of the right-wing conservatives now decide that they're going to be fiscal with defense. When they had perfect opportunities over the last decade to do that, and now it's became a popular thing within the party to be fiscal and a target, they decide now for votes that they want to go ahead and stand on a pedestal.
Yeah, John, let us pick it up right there, and forgive me, but we're up against the break here, and I want to get Christopher Preble to respond. We'll look at both parts of that, but first, Chris, just in half a minute here, we'll come back to it, but Secretary Gates says, don't stop now in Afghanistan. As John says, we just got 2 years of proper investment in there, Bob Gates says. Pull out now, McCain says, and you may be up against the old Taliban, Al-Qaeda problem there again. Don't stop now, Christopher.
Well, I think it reflects that the mission has changed. We went into Afghanistan in October of 2001 with a very simple goal that was to degrade Al-Qaeda's ability to do another 9/11. And we've done that. And the simple fact is the attack that ultimately resulted in killing Osama bin Laden didn't depend on having 100,000 troops on the ground in Afghanistan. We can continue to fight terrorism without stationing, trying to rebuild or build, frankly, from scratch, a functioning nation state in Afghanistan.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point with Money Short. We're talking today about bringing the U.S. military home, maybe from all over or from a lot of places. I'm asking how much could we, do we need to cut back on military spending and deployment? It is in the air now, whether you look at a Republican presidential contender campaign stage or in Congress, from both sides of the aisle, mayor's meeting in Baltimore this week, looking at a resolution saying, bring them home, spend it on bridges and infrastructure here. We need it. Christopher Preble is with us this hour from the Cato Institute, libertarian, says we can have a lot less presence abroad and a new strategy. Rachel Kleinfeld is with the Truman National Security Project out of Boulder, Colorado. She says, be careful. You got to be ready to do the necessary in the world. Stephen Walt is with us here in the studio from Harvard's Kennedy Kennedy School of Government. And Rachel, Christopher, Stephen, lots of response online. Vernon says on Facebook he agrees completely with Senator McCain. If we pull out of Afghanistan, we lose credibility in the Islamic world. The international community will be back in Afghanistan within 20 years, he says. Colin says on Twitter, it doesn't take much room to say this, I guess. Should we bring the troops home? Yes. It's the only way for us to signal the world. We can no longer be its policeman. Doug says we could easily pay for health care for every single American. But others are worried about that. Andrew on Facebook says bring our boys home. Send the bombs instead. Well, there's a lot of that going on with drones already right now. Ashley says, I believe having the sharpest sword and having the sharpest sword and the thicker armor, but not occupation. We're a security blanket for our friends, and only they're benefiting. We provide protection so they can focus money on improvements. Simone in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Thanks for calling, Simone. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to thank you first for bringing this issue up and center stage. I've been wondering for more than a year now why I never hear in all these discussions on the economy and the financial difficulties we face, why I never hear anything said about the military.
Well, never's a big word, but we're talking about it. What do you think?
Well, I believe it's high time to reduce military spending and military involvement around the world, especially because it seems that we're not, as it is, not fulfilling our obligations towards the returning veterans and their families with all the things that I hear about, you know, the disability issues or people being discharged when they really have a problem that comes from being traumatized in the war.
So cut back the spending, take care of the troops as they come home. Are you ready to do it?
Take care of the troops because we have, you know, we have that moral obligation, but I think that recognizing that makes it even more pressing that we bring them back. I do not advocate isolationism, however. I think it is also time to really work on an international cooperation among equals. I think the United States is not... has not behaved as an equal among peers in by any means.
Simone, let us look at that formulation there. Bring the troops home, but don't go for isolationism. That's interesting. Let me hold that thought for just a second. We'll come to it. I appreciate your call. Sam in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to say first, I want to say thank you to all our service people, and the work they do is great.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate them. We do have enemies around the world who are really dangerous. But we do have a really serious major financial problem in the country right now. We're basically printing almost half the money we need to run the country, including, you know, half of that goes to the military, the rest to Medicare. And I think if we give the mission to our military to reduce their costs, to run on a shoestring budget if you have to, they will do it, and they will defend us, and they will do the best possible job they can. My concern is project forward then from there. And what will they do? What they will do is they'll move towards a more robotic military. We'll have robotic warriors, like the Predator drones. And what my concern is with this is that we have this technology. It's getting more and more prevalent. They will go to that. They will have to go to that because it will be the only way to defend us, and they can project ultimate power, zero vulnerability, and therefore we take the human element completely out of war, and I don't see then that we will ever be able to end war.
We'll just have drones circling the planet all the time doing their thing. Sam, let us pick that one up as well. Christopher Rebel, let me bring that one straight to you. If we cut back, but yet there are threats, and already, I mean, you can read it in the headlines almost every day now, there's talk about drones and how much is going on there. Do we turn into a, you know, drone factory, robot war country?
Well, I think we have to take great pride as a nation in our ability to leverage our technology to allow us to do things that we used to take, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of troops and to do it with far fewer troops. I think the real danger has been that we have traded our technological advantages in a place like Afghanistan and fighting quite literally in the mud and the dirt with people who are armed with Enfield rifles from, you know, the turn of the previous century.
But is there a risk of eliciting more sort of our caller says heartless, nonstop warfare?
Yeah, so let me finish my point, which is that I think that there are many wars of choice. I think that's a term that we should understand rather well. Most American wars are wars of choice. And if a military intervention abroad does not directly relate to U.S. national security, if there is not broad public support for it, if we don't pay for it, I would argue in advance, pay for it. And if we don't understand what the mission and how we're going to achieve the mission and therefore what our exit strategy is, then we should not do it. And I would argue that most of the interventions that we've undertaken since the end of the Cold War do not meet those simple criteria. These are not revolutionary criteria. They're like the Weinberger-Powell Doctrine from the 1980s. If it was good enough for fighting the Soviet Union and staying out of stupid wars then it's certainly good enough for staying out of stupid wars now.
Rachel Kleinfeld, what about our caller Simone? She says she wants to bring troops home, but not to be isolationist. You know, be out, be engaged. Be engaged as a peer, she'd like to see. But what about that posture? Do you buy it? Can it work?
I think Simone is exactly right. That's the kind of creative rethinking that we need to be doing to our security posture. Bringing the troops home, we need to reduce our troops. That's clear. Most of the cost of our military budget is in troops, personnel, and health care costs and so on. The only way to reduce that is to reduce the numbers. And for a strong economy, we need to do that. But that does not mean becoming isolationist. There are countries out there that need our help now. If we don't spend a little now, we're going to be spending a lot more later. And so working with other countries, spending on development, spending on our diplomats, working on international troops that can defend their own areas, whether that's Europe or Africa or parts of Asia, those are the kinds of things that we can do to be more creative in our spending and stay secure and not be isolationist. Simone is right on.
But how far do you go with that? Should we send more, diplomats to Japan and not be there, or Korea or Okinawa or Germany?
This is all about balancing. What we have to deal with is the fact that we have real values in tension here. America wants to be a country that's a force for good in the world. John McCain, the Republican former presidential candidate, was recently saying that he didn't recognize the Republican Party of today, that Reagan wouldn't have recognized it because it had no desire to be a force for good in the world anymore. We want to do that. That's a core part of being American. There's also a pragmatic realization. We cannot start printing money ad infinitum. At a certain point, that comes home to roost. We have to take seriously our national interests and pick and choose. And then there's the reality that we can't just pull out. It takes time to redeploy from forward positions. If you ask any of our troops, it's the most dangerous thing that you can do is to break down a perimeter and start pulling back. That costs money, too. So we've got some real values and tension, and we have to balance them.
Let me go to John in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is, if the United States was to pull out of Afghanistan, would Al-Qaeda sort of reorganize itself and start hitting the United States with a lot of terrorist attacks that we would not be able to accept? I don't see the situation really improving as it is right now. I think the solution at this point is political. The military is very effective at what it is doing, but I think things have stalled at this point.
Hey, John, let us pick it up. Stephen Walt, you said failed Afghan campaign earlier, I believe. But here's the point that Bob Gates is making. He's saying, look, it's only 2 years that we've put the proper investment in here, his way of characterizing it. If we go now, John McCain and others, saying, sooner or later, we're going to be staring right back down the barrel of the threat that was some version of what we saw before. Taliban back, Al-Qaeda back, we can't leave there.
this is the primary justification, actually, the Obama administration has used for escalating the war in Afghanistan and continuing it. It's the so-called safe haven argument. And I think it's actually fundamentally wrong, even if you assume sort of the worst case here, that if we were to withdraw from Afghanistan and if the Taliban were to take control of some substantial part of the country, the real question is, would that substantially increase Al-Qaeda's ability to threaten the United States? And I don't think that's at all true.
Why not? It clearly did before.
It did before. But first of all, Al-Qaeda is now in many other places. It doesn't need bases in Afghanistan. Second, the 9/11 campaign was not primarily, or the 9/11 strike was not primarily organized out of Afghanistan. It was organized out of Pakistan and out of Hamburg, Germany. in many ways, Pakistan is a better location for al-Qaeda than Afghanistan is. And then most importantly, even if the Taliban were to permit al-Qaeda cells to relocate, they would have to be clandestine, they would have to be covert, because unlike the 1990s, we would not hesitate to go after anything we detected, as we are doing today with drone strikes in Pakistan and elsewhere. So they're not going to be able to organize large training camps that we can see, that we can go after. It's not going to be a substantial increase. So the question you want to ask yourself is, should the United States be spending $100 billion a year in a country whose entire GDP is only about $14 billion a year, in order to prevent a very remote possibility that Afghanistan will substantially increase al-Qaeda's capabilities? Point is, if we win in Afghanistan, it's not going to affect al-Qaeda one way or the other. If we lose in Afghanistan, it's not going to affect al-Qaeda one way or the other.
What about, we've got listeners online saying, well, maybe that's not even why we're there anymore. Maybe it's because right next door you've got nuclear on Pakistan looking so unstable. That's why we've got 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
But having 100,000 troops in Afghanistan doesn't help you deal with the Pakistan problem, which is a very serious problem, but it's not going to be solved by having 100,000 troops fighting counterinsurgency warfare and attempting nation building in Afghanistan. One could even argue that we may be making the situation in Pakistan worse over time.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York, and Kevin. Kevin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question involves the role or the impact of contractors on the budget, not the military budget, or if it's related to the military budget. And kind of the perspective, historical perspective of the role of contractors and what it will mean in the future, the use of contractors to the, its impact on the U.S. budget.
Yeah, Kevin, let us pick it up. Christopher Preble, how about that? If we bring the troops home, we'll just turn around, and next thing you know, we'll be spending it on Blackwater or Z or whatever they're calling themselves now. We'll spend it on private contractors all over the place.
Well, it is true that contractors have been used by the U.S. government to conceal from the American people the true cost of our foreign policy. So if someone wants to engage in something abroad but doesn't want to call attention using the 82nd Airborne, they'll send a contractor. I think we do need to crack down on that.
But it still shows up in the Pentagon bottom line.
Again, there needs to be oversight. Congress needs to be involved in this, and there needs to be attention to the fact that when you engage in operations abroad, they are not cost-free. There are risks. But I also want to get back at this question about isolation versus engagement. We have allowed people like John McCain to define American engagement around the world as a military operation, that if we are not engaged militarily around the world, that we are somehow embracing isolationism. I think he frankly does a disservice to the memory of Ronald Reagan, who avoided a number of costly wars, drew forces out of Lebanon when a number of McCain's friends would have had us double down there. And I think that we used to engage in the world as a model. We put our own house in order, and we stood as a symbol for others to emulate. We did not go around trying to tell them how to govern their country, how to run their schools, how to administer justice. This is a new thing for the United States, and it's something that is deeply inconsistent with our values as a country. We should not be in the business of telling other people how to run their countries. We need to get out of that game.
Rachel Kleinfeld, we have a lot of listeners online, or some anyway here, on the other hand, asserting that the way the world works is like this, that some country, somebody, has to be the big dog. The policeman, call it what you want. And that if the United States isn't, somebody else will emerge in that role. Now, China may only spend 1/6 of what we do today on military, but their economy, many people anticipate, everybody does, will be bigger than ours before you know it. If we step out of this role, does it just mean that 50 years down the road we turn around and it's China with troops all over the place?
Well, Madeleine Albright was known to say that America was the indispensable nation, and we've often thought of ourselves that way. I think the way to think about our posture right now is that there are many threats in the world. Some are militarily solvable. Some are not easily solved by the military, but they're nevertheless threats, whether that's cybersecurity threats, bioterrorism threats, terrorism at home. For our military posture, we need to not get bogged down. We don't want to be Gulliver tied down by the Lilliputians and unable to respond elsewhere, which is what our current posture is forcing us to do. We're not lithe. We're not easily able to move from place to place to answer threats. We're basically the Incredible Hulk when we should be Spider-Man. And we need to be thinking about a lighter posture and what's actually able to be solved by the military and what's not. None of that means that America gives up being a strong country and a leading country. In fact, it enables us to lead because it doesn't destroy our economy while we're putting our military out there. One of the realities of national strength is that no country with a weak economy has been a strong country for long. So we need to balance these things.
Stephen Walt says we could save a third of our military spending. That's hundreds of billions of dollars. Do you agree?
Do I agree that we could save that much money if we reduced the size of
on
our
that
personnel?
Scale? Yeah. Well, you know, any way you like. Could we cut back, pull back to that degree, that kind of savings?
Well, Stephen Walt was talking about the numbers based on our troop deployments and our current wars. Our current wars alone are costing quite a bit of that budget. So if you cut Iraq and Afghanistan, yes, sure, you could get close to that number.
Stephen Walt, do you think we'll be out of those two? I mean, given what we're up against fiscally, will we be out of Iraq and Afghanistan, I don't know, 5 years from now, substantially or not?
Yeah, I think Iraq, there's no sign that we're going to stay there in substantial strength. There have been occasional voices saying that we really need to hang out there, but I don't think the Iraqis really want us to stay. And in fact, the smaller our presence is, the more popular we're likely to be in Iraq, the more they might be willing to have some sort of role for the United States. Afghanistan is going to be a tougher problem. We learned today in the newspaper that we are, in fact, talking to the Taliban. I think that's a sign that the United States is looking for a way to, say, find an easy exit out in the relatively near future. But my guess is we'll be there for several more years at a minimum.
Well, some great perspective today as the fiscal debate heats up again over this summer, and we're grateful for it. Stephen Walt with Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you so much for being here today, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Christopher Preble in Washington with the Cato Institute. Thank you for joining us, Christopher.
Thank you, Tom.
And Rachel Kleinfeld with the Truman National Security Project joining us from Boulder, Colorado. Rachel, thanks so much for your time and insights.
Terrific to be here, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.